Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The Qatar World Cup is finally here. But just what kind of place is hosting the biggest sporting event on the planet? I'm Kate Mason, and in September, I went to Doha to see things for myself.
It was the weirdest day of my life.
It said Qatar is doing everything it can. How do you quantify that? That's the sort of thing you can just say.
So basically they wanted to charge me under the Espionage Act.
I've spoken to female footballers in the country, the first Qatari man to come out as gay, residents in Doha whose future is uncertain, and the workers who helped build this World Cup, all to find out how it's changed people's lives there.
There's like so many like opportunities and stadiums for women to use, but like it's just that they don't want to because they can't.
And the big question is, what's going to happen after the World Cup? What's going to happen when that spotlight moves on?
Physical health, everybody knows, but nobody knows the mental health.
This is Inside the Qatar World Cup, the Football Ramble's brand new three-part series. You can listen to all three episodes right now. Just search Football Ramble in your favourite podcast app.
Welcome to On the Continent at the World Cup. I'm Dotun Adebayo, I'm Andy Brassel, and I'm Nicky Bandini. I'm all three of them for now, so let me do it again from the top. Welcome to On the Continent at the World Cup. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Nicky Bandini.
On this World Cup history repeating itself edition, can the team formerly known as Mannschaft get out of the group stage in Qatar with or without a FIFA gag? Talking of the Germans, can seven-scoring Spain do better than anything the Japanese can do to Germany, or will the real Germans stand up to them? And how he took a sad song and made it a French national goal-scoring record. We're singing his praises. Na 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 Giroud. With apologies for my singing, before we begin and get really into those topics that we're discussing today, there is a question from Josh. After last night's late kickoff, please recap Canada's domination of Belgium. Nikki, are you ready to get your teeth into this one?
It was a really interesting game. I think we've had some upsets in the last few days that we're going to get onto, at least one of them. And they've been all along, I guess, the same sort of line where you have the traditional juggernaut is dominant and just doesn't manage to score the goals it needs to. This was nothing like that. Belgium did win, so it wasn't an upset in the end. But in terms of the football, they were outplayed, I felt like, for really the vast majority of the 90 minutes. And you've got Kevin De Bruyne at the end receiving the Man of the Match award and going, I literally don't know why I'm being given this. Like, I don't know. This shouldn't be for me. It was a really fascinating game of football. Obviously, it's sort of, I think it's always a thrill when there's a country that hasn't been in a World Cup for a while and you get them back there, just hearing them sing the national anthem at the beginning, obviously that sort of Oh Canada moment. And then they came out and played the way they did. I thought it was a really, really impressive performance and just, I suppose, a little bit heartbreaking for them to put in such a strong performance against a team that is considered a contender and still come away with nothing for it.
Andy, I suppose this is summed up by what Nicky was saying there, that Kevin De Bruyne didn't want the Man of the Match award because he knew he didn't deserve it. Somebody maybe on the Canadian team deserved it more.
Yeah, I mean, the way these Man of the Match awards work at World Cups, Kevin De Bruyne is very perceptive, not only on the field, but off it. And I think the second part of that, he said, I think they said that because they want to interview me afterwards. That's exactly what has happened there. Because basically, if you're Man of the Match, you go into the flash interview directly after the game. And that's the only reason anyone got to speak to Cristiano Ronaldo in the 2018 World Cup when he was trying to keep a lid on the fact that he was going to Juventus. So well worked out by KDB there. I think this group is really interesting now as well, because you look at Belgium's myriad issues. I think a lack of athleticism is a clear one. And I think you look at Croatia's midfield, which, you know, is arguably one of the best midfields in the tournament, although Spain might have put an end to that discussion yesterday, as we'll come to in a little bit. And I thought Morocco looked decent in the first game as well. It's all open. Also, Steven Eustáquio of Porto, who I had a feeling would be good during this tournament because he's in incredible form domestically. I thought he was the best player on the pitch and he should have got it if we were giving it on merit rather than who the cameras like the look of.
Andy, you were in the stadium when Japan beat Germany. How did they pull that off?
Well, I think with patience and excellent organisation, for a start, I thought Germany were actually okay in the first half. And I spoke to Ilkka Gundogan afterwards and he said, I thought we played okay. And I think you can have sympathy for that. But we'll come back to Germany's issues in a minute. I thought the coaching was good. The way they reorganised at half-time and went to five at the back was good. They pressed a little bit harder. that they made it tougher on Germany as the game went on, and they took a few little risks as well. I think we saw that, and we've seen how that's paid off in other games in the World Cup so far, notably in the Argentina-Saudi Arabia one. But I think what is the most delicious element of all this is the fact that there's this strong Bundesliga influence to the Japanese team. You know, you look at five of the starters currently playing the Bundesliga. Both the goal scorers, Doan and Asano, are currently in the Bundesliga as well. You know, if it was going to happen to Germany, it was always going to happen in this way, I think.
I think there's something really fascinating in that. I don't know if you're expecting Andy, so any sort of response from, if there's any Bundesliga owners that are combustible enough to respond as Perugia's Gauci did famously to Arne scoring against Italy for South Korea and knocking them out. And you know, it crossed my mind that even, of course, Italy's elimination from this World Cup, the goal scorer for North Macedonia was a former Palermo player, Trajkovski. And sorry, I'm butchering everyone's names today. But it was a former Palermo player scoring at Palermo's home stadium, in fact. So I wonder if there's even something a little bit beyond just the sort of random factor. There is something in familiarity and the power in that. But certainly it was Arne I was thinking about as Bundesliga players didn't knock Germany out yet, but put them in a tough spot to start this tournament.
Indeed. And that is the question that Joe wanted to ask on Instagram, by the way. How strong is this Japanese presence in the Bundesliga and why? Let's concentrate on the why. How come there are so many Japanese, and we're talking about the top Japanese, why are they going to the Bundesliga rather than anywhere else?
Success breeds success, Dotton, quite simply. I think you look at particularly Makoto Hasebe and Shinji Kagawa, for example, in the last 15 years, players who've made a huge impact and didn't cost a lot of money. You know, if we're talking about Bundesliga resource, there's always been a limit because of the limits of club ownership and because of the limits of the TV deal, which is something that if we go back 20 years, Bayern were always like wriggling to sort of find a way to expand commercially. As well as producing your own players, which they've done exceptionally well since the reformation of the academy system 20 odd years ago, getting players who are moldable in that way and cheap. Bear in mind, Kagawa cost €300,000 for Dortmund. Is something that has worked again and again and again. And I think Doan's an interesting example, the scorer of the first goal. I mean, he was on the pitch about 5 minutes before he got that goal, wasn't he? And, you know, he had a spell at Armenia Bielefeld before in which he was really, really influential. Went back to PSV, where he was on loan from, and now has ended up at Freiburg, and he is the ultimate Freiburg player. You know, they're hardworking, enterprising, play really tidy football, and he ticks all of those boxes. And to get himself in that spot to finish off that goal was kind of typical of him. But I wanted to ask Nicky actually about that. You know, Asano has had a difficult season, like Bochum have had a difficult season until the last couple of weeks because he's been injured most of it. But do you reckon he learnt that touch off Dennis Bergkamp when he was at Arsenal?
I knew you were going to tee me up, Andy, for my Arsene Wenger Arsene knows segment. I mean, I think it's almost like a gag, isn't it? Like a cliche now about Wenger, that Wenger tried to sign so and so and did sign so and so. But yes, of course, Asano was an Arsenal signing who then Arsenal couldn't keep because it turned out they weren't able to get the work permit for him back in 2016, I think. So Wenger did know, and perhaps that's a theme that we'll come back to later in this show as well.
Wenger knew, but Germany clearly didn't. What went wrong from their perspective, though? Because it was a game of two halves, and the first half, I know that's a cliche, but it's the first one we've had on this podcast, but the first half, it looked like the Germany that you expect, that they were going to be very efficient and hold on to a 1-0 lead. Second half, Where were they?
I think it's a really interesting question, Dotton, and it's a really interesting way of framing it as well, because what we expect from Germany at a tournament is not what this Germany team under Hansi Flick or previously under latter-day Joachim Löw can really provide. And if we were looking for a return to that traditional Germany, Flick was never going to be the coach to provide it. He's a risk-taking coach. He hasn't got as good players as he has at Bayern. I think obviously he has some of them. And there is a lot of talent there. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think Germany are really performing to modern type, in that I think if you were defending Germany, as Gundogan did to a certain extent, you would say, well, they had the chances to win the game. You look at how many saves the Japanese goalkeeper had to make. I think that there's some merit in that, even though the tide of the game really changed in the second half. But this is Germany all over. You go back to the two Nations League games with England. They lead and dominate in both of them, and they manage to make a right royal mess of it defensively. They should have won in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, where they always win recently, going back to that, and they threw a lead as well. And the defending on both of those goals, I mean, with the Doan goal, they had a little warning with that, didn't they? Because there was an almost identical move before that where, I can't remember the player who was coming in, like stuck the rebound over the top. And then they didn't heed that warning at all, because Doan scored from a similar situation like a couple of minutes later. And then just the total disorganisation. I mean, Nico Schlotterbeck has had the heat for the ball going over his head and Asano getting there. But really, Schlotterbeck shouldn't be there. If the left back is in the right spot, David Raum, then Schlotterbeck's not all the way over there. They haven't really got a right back that's fit for purpose. So, I mean, having been there and part of what was a really terrific occasion, and the Japanese supporters were fantastic. In one sense, the Japanese supporters pushed them over the line and they didn't stop at the entire game. But if Germany are anywhere near organised, they win that game.
It's an interesting point about Raum, Andy, because it felt like the formation, as you see in lots of teams, I think at the moment it's very much sort of the trend in football, isn't it? It's a back four, but it often doesn't look like a back four. And Raum really was playing like a winger a lot of the game. And in the first half, that was sort of tremendously effective for Germany. And this was kind of the great success for Moriyasu, that the Japan coach, was that he took off a winger and brought on an extra centre-back in the second half and shored up that side of the defence and stopped Raum from running riot. And then in the end, Japan, as you said, were able to exploit down that side. I do think, I should have said this when we were talking about Japan before, not Germany, but I mean, this is my favourite goal of the tournament so far. I thought Asano takes it so well. The angle is ridiculous, even though I'm sure Neuer doesn't want to get beaten there. But yeah, I think it's interesting the way you framed it, the way both of you framed it, actually, because Dotton talking about a Germany that you expect, and I thought to myself, as soon as you said that, I thought, what Germany do I expect? Because I think in my head, there's a sort of old image of Germany, which for some reason for me is sort of almost, I think, embodied in the figure of Bastian Schweinsteiger, who's sort of more sort of combative and solid and I sort of just believe will come out on top at the end of something. And I think Andy's exactly right that this is not and hasn't been for a while that Germany. And I think it's okay. Like, you don't have to sort of always have the same footballing identity over time, and I think Flick very possibly is approaching things in the right way for the talent that he has. But I actually just thought about that, maybe it's too intangible, but that idea of auras and what's been lost, and it feels like the sort of steady degradation of that invincible aura that Germany had, that's been going on for ages. It's been ages since I've looked at Germany and thought in a major tournament they're going to be untouchable. I did see that this was, I think, the first time at a World Cup since something like 1978 that they've gone ahead and then been ahead at half time and then lost. So it is certainly like true that they historically haven't thrown away leads. But I don't think of Germany as being that team anymore, that unstoppable juggernaut. Mm. And I do wonder how those sort of subtle, I don't know, impressions over time just allow opponents to approach things on the pitch in a different way, to have a little bit more belief in themselves that actually you can turn this game over.
They do have the players, though. They still have the players. This is what shocks me almost, that, you know, their players are some of the best players in the world in their team when you look at their squad, and yet they don't seem to be able to make it all gel together and work. And I suppose that's what's most surprising. When I was talking about German efficiency, it's the old cliche of Der Technische Sprung, whatever the advert was. And like Nikki says,
Vorsprung durch Technik.
Thank you. I never owned one, so how would I remember that? But like Nikki says, Andy, like Nikki says, you know, that the moment she said Sebastian Schweinsteiger, I totally got it. Yeah, it's not that team. Not because of the players' quality, but because of, I don't know, arguably, do we have to look at the coach? Do we have to look at the tactics? What do we have to
look
at?
You know what, though, Dotton, you can say it's not about the players, but it partly is about the players, because Germany produces a different type of player nowadays. Now, I think of, like, Jamal Musiala, who was really great, by the way, I thought, and hopefully there's a lot more to come from him in the World Cup. They really need something from him in the Spain game, with the second game, as we'll come to. Well, that's it. I mean, we're talking about the sort of players that Germany produce, or the sort of players that England produce for Germany, depending on which way you look at it. But, you know, I think the characteristics of modern German players are so different, you know. Maybe a bit more flair and a little less rigorous, if I can be so broad in my brushstrokes. But, you know, I think in another way, that feeds into something that I like really appealing about modern German footballers and a lot of modern footballers generally. I mean, the way that Germany have reacted to the armband thing, which is obviously... Which has obviously like taken a lot of column inches, and rightly so, in the last little while. I found that was such a powerful image before the game, when you saw the players doing the team photo with their hands over their mouths. And okay, it's something that the German FA believe, the DFB believe as well, but it's player-led as well, which I think is really super important to acknowledge. You know, there are a lot of players in that team, and I'm thinking particularly of Joshua Kimmich, Leon Goretzka, who, you know, really were quite entrepreneurial in their charity and social engagement efforts during the pandemic, for example. In those two cases, they raised millions. These are not players who will stay silent, and that's despite the way that FIFA have approached this, which is, you know, been a disgrace. I mean, you had Denmark threatening to leave FIFA yesterday, of course. But I think the fact that, you know, this sort of battle between the nations and FIFA is so interesting, because obviously everyone saw that photo, that team photo of the German players with their hands over their mouths on social media. Well, right. They saw it on social media. They didn't see it on telly, because FIFA controls the feed, obviously. So FIFA was trying to not let us see that, but obviously it's far harder to cover stuff up in the social media age.
I would love one footballer in this tournament, because I believe that there is a lot of empathy and solidarity. I do. And of course, Leon Goretzka, I think about the heart gesture he made to the Hungary fans who were sort of being furiously intolerant. And actually, what a powerful gesture that was at the time. I think there is solidarity. I think there has been a lack of courage from some. But I would love to see one footballer just dye their hair in the rainbow colours, because you could do that, and then what's FIFA going to do about it? And it's not like footballers don't dye their hair different colours and make gestures like that just for their own reasons all the time. I'd love to see someone. This was something, and it was appreciated because it was more than other people have done. But I still feel like there is a disconnect between sort of the rhetoric and the willingness to actually put yourself out there in the way that perhaps the Iran players did when they made their protest against England.
Lovely touch that from Asano, and Asano has managed to sneak in. What a wonderfully well taken goal.
Hold up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Well, we're lucky to have Andy Brassel be our eyes and ears at the World Cup tournament in Qatar itself. And Andy, I imagine the last couple of days you've been surrounded by Spanish football fans singing Guantanamera, Guantanamera, but not the way we sing it, because they'll be thinking Campeones, Campeones, and seven, as De La Soul would say to them, is the magic number, is it not?
Well, three was at half time, wasn't it? And you kind of thought that
very
would be enough
good
for them. I mean,
you are so slick, Mr. Brassel.
Thank you. In terms of tournament authenticity, like part of the tournament experience when you're there is that you miss quite a lot of football because while you're at games. So I arrived back at half time. I ended up watching the first half like later on, and so I had my nose pressed to the window of a shisha house watching like the three goals that I scored in the first half while I was on my way back to my hotel from the Germany game. But of course Costa Rica, there's been a lot made, and I spoke to a couple of the TalkSport commentators. I spoke to Nigel Adderley about it earlier, and he was saying how there was this feeling that Costa Rica were doing such a rigorous warm-up. I think him and Stuart Pearce were saying, do you maybe want to save a bit for the game? It's quite hot out there. And you know, when the game started, you know, it was Spain. I think such an interesting thing is they had just over a third of the shots that Canada had in their game against Belgium, and yet they ended up with seven goals. Now, we don't really think of Spain as being clinical, do we? But when Spain functioned well under Luis Enrique, it's not passing for passing's sake. It's actually very economical, direct in its own way. And I think despite the fact they didn't take the field with a proper centre-forward, inverted commas, because, of course, Asensio played there and Morata was on the bench and came on and got his goal for number seven, showing their strength in depth, this felt like a very Luis Enrique Spain performance to me.
When we saw at the end of 90 minutes, the ref or the fourth official put up the sign for about 9 minutes more agony for Costa Rica, you were thinking, for the love of God, no, no. No. And yet,
yeah.
We knew that Alvaro Morata had to get a goal. We knew that because Spain, first half certainly didn't play with your traditional centre forward, brought a centre forward in the second half. And for that 7-0 to make sense, that centre forward had to show the difference between having a traditional centre forward and not having a traditional centre forward. And he got it in the end, didn't he?
He did. I mean, I don't know, Dutton, I suppose, because the player who was notionally the started at centre forward, Asensio, I think he scored once in his previous 31 international caps, and he scored too. So everyone got in on the goals in this one. I think I was more sort of captured in my viewing by Gavi and Pedri again, just because they're teenagers, and it's ridiculous that you can sort of be a teenager and step onto the pitch and control score. It with that amount of authority. And in Gavi's case, score as well.
Yeah.
And
I mean, youngest Spanish goal scorer at the World Cup, of course. But I don't know how you feel about this, Nicky, but as you say, it feels very nominal, Pedri and Gavi being teenagers, because they've just got this incredible wisdom. I mean, I don't want to go back to club football, but it's something that me and David Cartledge have touched on before. If Barcelona had behaved like a normal club, you know, they had all the pieces in midfield. They just would have not risked their entire financial future and do what they always do and build round youth products / young players, because goodness knows how far those two could take them.
Yeah, and I think without sort of making it about the club football part of it is really important. And I feel like this is the most boring drum that I end up beating every single time there's a major international tournament. But I think it really does matter that the players you've got in your squad want to spend time together and enjoy spending time together. And clearly Pedri and Gavi have got a dynamic off the pitch as well. You see it. There was a red carpet ceremony not long ago, and you saw the little understanding they have with each other, the way they look to each other in like a sort of like supportive way, and like just looking out for each other as kids in this sort of grown up world. I think like sort of having your mate there is really valuable. And I also think for a team like Spain going into a tournament, you know, not that it isn't also hugely valuable to have experience and to have players who've been there and done it before, but I think there's something really uplifting for any national team when you've got a couple of teenagers who are genuinely brilliant in your squad, who just approach it like kids who want to go and play football and have that sheer sort of like childlike joy about it, which can get lost sometimes. And I think there was a real contrast in this game, because actually the Costa Rica lineup, I think I saw there were 6 out of the 11 that started in this game were also in the starting lineup when they first qualified, like, and they opened their tournament in Brazil back in 2014. So of course there's also something in the fact that Spain play incredibly advanced, nuanced tactical football, that you've got not just a false nine in Marco Asensio, but like a false centre back in Rodri, who's distributing and playing in a position that you wouldn't normally think is his position, and does that so effectively. You've got two expert wingers, Dani Olmo, sort of doing that really effective job of cutting in from the left-hand flank for Ferran Torres, who I thought was phenomenal. I mean, this team is really, really good. And I do think in all the pre-tournament chat, not that people were completely overlooking them, but I think people might have underestimated quite how good they have been. I mean, the fact is that this team, I will say as an Italian, was the best team at the Euros. Italy beat them in a one-off game, and it was probably the most sort of interesting game of the tournament. But Spain were the best team at the Euros, and they then went and won the Nations League right afterwards and sort of proved the point by dominating Italy in that as well. This is probably, has been in the last few years, Europe's best team. They've got these teenagers who are young and healthy and enthusiastic. I think this was not a sort of out of nowhere result. I think this team is very much one of the front runners to win the whole thing.
Question from Liam on Instagram is about Rodri. And he's asking, will Rodri stay centre-back for Spain, or is that just a weapon for games when Spain will control the ball? Andy?
I think you could argue that their plan will be to control the ball in more games than they don't, certainly. You know, I think even when we go back to that Euro semi-final that Nicky was talking about, you know, they were, even if they didn't win, they were dominant. So I could see that as something that they stick with. Also, I think one of Spain's biggest problems is they've got a terrific centre-back in Pau Torres and a terrific goalkeeper in Unai Simón, both who've got a ricket in them. So, you know, you're not talking about breaking up an impermeable defence. In terms of leaders in the team, though, going back to that, I think the leadership is all with Luis Enrique. He's cut like a very... Like, I mean, he's always very frank, but I think he's cut quite... and he's got the courage of his convictions. I mean, we saw that all the way going back to when he was coach of Roma, Nicky. You know, he was... Mm. His philosophies were something... a hill he was prepared to fall down, you know. So I think if you look at that and the way that he's behaved, you know, he's very active on social media. He's got his Twitch channel. He feels like relaxed and like he's enjoying it and really embracing it. And I think that conveys trust in the players to a certain extent. And the fact that he didn't bring Sergio Ramos and he didn't bring Thiago, because he just trusts those players that he has with him. Obviously, there are the more experienced players in the likes of Jordi Alba, for example. But I think he really believes in this group of players, and it feels to me in the way they play that like they feel that.
I think one other thing that I just wanted to sort of say about like the possession side of things, which I think is really interesting, when you play this sort of aggressively possession-oriented football that Spain play and that Luis Enrique has committed them to, it made me think about lots of managers in international football who've been successful in recent times, and certainly Roberto Mancini at the Euros was very focused on, we want to play with the ball as Italy because you enjoy yourself when you've got the ball. You have fun, right? So that's fun for the players. And if a player's having fun, they're going to play better. But there's a second side to that, which is if you don't let your opponents touch the ball, they're going to get increasingly frustrated and miserable. Mm. And I think this Spain team, actually, like, part of what makes it so effective is you just take all of the energy out of your opponent. You take everything out of them by saying, no, this is just us playing and you're just going to have to sit there and watch us. And of course, there's such a thing as sterile possession. You see that, and there are clubs in European football who waste that possession and don't use it. But I think there is an experience playing against this Spain team when they're as good as this, and which they did to teams of the Euros as well, of just making you feel completely hopeless. Just, you're not going to play football. We're going to play football. And when we want to, we're going to win this game. And that, I think, is a really stark contrast with the upsets we've seen at this tournament. Because Argentina were better than Saudi Arabia. Germany probably were better than Japan. But they didn't win because they didn't take the life out of their opponents. They let their opponents believe they were still a way back in, whereas Spain didn't let Costa Rica believe that for a second.
Having said that, Germany set a World Cup record with 422 completed passes in that first half. So when they meet Spain with their possession football, begs the question, what happens? Germany have got to win it. They need to win it because it's like the World Cup final for them. But for Spain, they can be very relaxed with their passing, Andy, can't they?
I mean, I don't think they will be, because that's not the personality of them or their coach. And I think the opportunity to knock out a team that rightly or wrongly you see as a competitor, for it to present itself at this early stage, I mean, it's an opportunity you've got to try and grasp, I think. And obviously, Spain are feeling very good about themselves. I think certainly aesthetically, they've been the best team at the tournament in this opening round so far. And I say that despite the fact that England and France were both excellent. And like Nicky said, it's the absolute joy of the way they're playing. I think Germany would love to see themselves get to that point. And obviously Germany have taken a few beatings in recent times from Spain. Of course, there was the 6-0 as well. So they'll be quite keen to bite back at that. But you know, Germany will have to be brave, but they're always brave. They're always a little too brave on some occasions. So I think this is very interesting indeed.
I think it's really relevant as well that Japan play Costa Rica before Spain play Germany on Sunday. So if Japan win, Germany will know that's it. Like, you literally have to win this game or you're going out, which is really going to raise the stakes for that one, I think.
Got a hand on the ball. Maratra seen Gavi! That was special, wasn't it? And he is special.
So, on this goonatastic edition, World Cup edition of On the Continent, of course, the defending champions, France, hit the ground running with 4 against Australia's 1. And Giroud got 2 of them. Do you remember when you lot used to sing, na, 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 Giroud?
Of course I remember that, Josh, and I have sung that song, not as beautifully as you just did, obviously. when I was sort of prodding before about the Arsene Wenger link here. Well, of course, it's because Giroud matched Thierry Henry's international goal scoring record. So it was one Arsene Wenger sort of Arsenal signing to another in terms of the passing of the baton. I think regular On the Continent listeners have no doubt heard me sort of wax lyrical about this before with Giroud, because it's been a theme for Milan over the last couple of seasons. I think the thing for me with him is just his absolute unflappability with the bigger stages. That has been such a huge part of what made him transformative for Milan in winning the title last season, was being the player who scored 2 goals when they were losing the derby and transformed that game, who scored on the last day of the season, who scored in really every single big game for Milan last season when they needed him to. Sure, he got into double figures, and that was meaningful in itself because he broke this supposed curse of the number 9 shirt at Milan that no one since Pippo Inzaghi had hit double figures in it. But it was the games he scored in over and over again that stood out to me. And I think it's sort of fascinating then to put that alongside, yes, nobody thinks, I don't believe, that Giroud is as transformative and special a player as Thierry Henry was. But when it comes to just scoring goals in important games, well, he's done it for France again and again, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I think there are 2 elements to this, really, Nikki. I think, firstly, the fact that he's so incredibly selfless as well. That is something that makes his teammates love him. You know, Hugo Lloris spoke to me about it afterwards, and he was so pleased for him. You know, he was important at the 2018 World Cup. There was a big fuss made about him not scoring, but you can't say he didn't play his part in that. He was really, really important. Giroud adds more balance to the team than Benzema. I think you can definitely argue that. And it always felt like that. It felt like Mbappe was in a better place. It felt like Griezmann, even though he's deeper, was in a better place. I thought he was absolutely terrific and maybe man of the match. But it's funny that Giroud is kind of defined, at least for the moment, by his goals. When the goals are almost anecdotal to what he does in a leadership role in some ways. I think the other thing that's worth noting about Giroud is, in amongst that non-flashness that we talked about, you know, he's not a blingy superstar by any stretch of the imagination, is the fact that actually, if you talk to him, he's got enormous self-confidence, absolutely enormous self-confidence, and he's had to have, because there's been in France, I think, going back a little while, there's always been a little bit of snobbery about him, because he's not an academy starlet or anything like that. He's the working man who worked his way up, you know, through lower divisions and, you know, winning the title at Montpellier, not always been a starter at Arsenal and Chelsea. But to have that belief, that directly taps in to what he can do. Because you think he wasn't first choice at Arsenal and Chelsea, arguably wasn't first choice at Milan when he came in. But when they need him, just like when France need him, he's ready. He's ready to receive the opportunity. And, you know, it would be easy to sulk. And, of course, when Deschamps replaced him with Benzema, Deschamps spoke quite openly about probably not bringing him to this World Cup, because he thought, well, you know, he was the starter and now he's got to back up. And it's all about, you know, squad mood and squad equilibrium and all that kind of stuff. But he said the way that, not what Giroud did on the pitch in recent games, because he knows what he can do on the pitch, but what he did off the pitch convinced him. And obviously, especially with Benzema getting injured, it's proved very good decision and very auspicious.
Arguably, we've all disrespected Giroud to a certain extent. I think the way that he portrays himself is part of that, like you say, with some humility. It struck me that the TV producer in the game against Australia just had his camera focused on Mbappe. Whereas with Giroud, the cameras should have been on Giroud because he was on the cusp of setting a French national record. And it's almost shocking. It was almost an afterthought. Oh, by the way, he's now equaled Thierry Henry's record. And you thought, hang on, how did we not know this? How did we not know? How did it creep up without us knowing it? And whilst you're answering that, Andy, tell us, what does he smell like?
Very, very nice, it has to be said. There are not many footballers who smell great directly after the match, but he definitely falls into that category. So we have to thank him for that.
So you are our eyes, ears and nose in Qatar.
Yeah, all the senses are important when I'm this far away from you guys, I think. But yeah, I think it's interesting. His situation in terms of the goal-scoring record, it reminds me a little bit of Marek Hamsik at Napoli. It's like a longevity record-based record, really, that will, as David was saying on yesterday's ramble, will ultimately be surpassed by Griezmann and by Mbappe at some point down the line. Now, I think, you know, the thought is to more angle towards Mbappe because, you know, he'll probably be scoring goals for France for the next 13, 14 years unless something goes horribly wrong. But Griezmann's not that far behind him. He's still only 31. I guess the only question is, because his role is sort of evolving, will he get in the penalty box that much to score those goals? Because he's such an incredible Swiss Army knife of a player. And we've talked a lot about him this season, his club situation, how he was only playing little cameo roles at the start of the season. And Didier Deschamps joked, oh, well, at least he'll be fresh for the World Cup. I mean, you know, you're talking about one of the fittest, hard-working superstar players out there, Griezmann. And it feels like they're getting all of that at the moment.
I think the sort of individual dynamics of specific players and their club situations coming into this World Cup is going to end up being a really fascinating sort of subplot of this tournament. I think we'll have a clearer picture of it by the end of the tournament, of course, because this was one game and France were absolutely dominant. But I agree with you, Andy, that Griezmann looked really, really sharp, really, really bright, really enjoying the freedom of that role behind the attack. And perhaps, again, a sort of another sort of player who just benefits from the sort of stability of Giroud almost, the consistency of knowing what you're going to get from him and what you can expect and how to operate off him. But I know I've just been enthusing about Spain and their prospects, but this France team, when you look at it sort of with a step back and you think, hang on, this team's still got, despite all their injuries, Giroud, Mbappe, Griezmann, Dembele. I think that team's pretty scary for anyone, isn't it? It's not just Australia.
Mm. Yeah, I think it is. In terms of their weak spots, I do think the Luka Hernandez injury is a big issue. And of course, you know, we think, and we're right to think, I suppose, it's quite an extraordinary twist how Luka Hernandez gets this awful knee injury that rules him out of the tournament and is replaced by his brother. And they're two very, very different left backs because Luka Hernandez is a left back / left centre back, and Teo is a wing back / wannabe centre forward. I mean, you know, he's the more aesthetically pleasing footballer, and we got to see his forward stuff. I mean, the cross for the Rabiot goal was brilliant, but I think what maybe we didn't see, because Australia aren't that strong, maybe what we saw only a little bit of defensively, his positioning is all over the shop, and maybe that ends up costing them against a better team, because, you know, France are playing, we talked about their scratch midfield, they're kind of playing with a scratch defence. You know, I think Konate and Upamecano are together because they know each other very well from Leipzig. Pavard got a lot of stick from the French media and from Jules yesterday about his positioning for that Goodwin goal as well. So yeah, there is still the feeling that, you know, they're there to be got at.
Okay, at this time, we normally ask you if, you know, you listen regularly to OTC, you'll know that we ask our experts to give us a Game of the Week recommendation. No need for that. I think we've got enough games to watch at the moment. Can't get any kick myself as a result of this. But I know, Andy, you're going to go and watch the battle of the Portuguese colonies and all.
Yeah, well, I'm going to attempt going to two games today and the logistical challenges that that might involve because they're back-to-back. I'm going to see Portugal versus Ghana and then Brazil versus Serbia, which is great, that I'm really looking forward to. But the player I'm most looking forward to watching in this double bill is actually Vitinha, if he starts. I think, you know, you look at how he has transformed PSG this season. He's made an absolutely enormous difference to them. I mean, the feeling is they might go with Ruben Neves for a little bit more muscle in there. But Vitinha has brought such incredible balance to PSG, a team that have like looked very lopsided with you know, the front three and the rest. I think if they were to include him, I think it would give them a level of control that would push them towards the contenders. I'm not quite ready to believe yet that they're going to be able to genuinely have a pop at the tournament, despite the fact that I think they've got the players to do it. And obviously, there's the whole Ronaldo thing hanging over them. And I think how he shakes out tonight is going to be very interesting.
And Nicky, in the absence of a game of the week, is there a player of the week maybe that's caught your eye that we should keep an eye on for the rest of this tournament?
Well, he hasn't caught my eye yet, but I'm just continuing on the game Andy was talking about. I'm really intrigued to see how Rafael Leao is going to do at this tournament. I think it's a fascinating dynamic just because at club level, he's so looked to at Milan as being the one sort of star of that team in an offensive sense, like the one sort of star can make some magic, can do something, can create a spark player. And at Portugal, it's not like that at all. He's surrounded by bigger names who have a bigger reputations and who are more likely to sort of grab the attention of defenders, I suppose. And I'm curious to see how that is going to play out for him. I think he hasn't scored yet for Portugal, so far he hasn't been able to make his mark in that way. But this is his first chance at a big tournament, and I'm excited to see how that plays out.
I just lost a bet with myself, Nikki, because I thought you were going to say Sergei Milinkovic-Savage, who I'm also very much looking forward to seeing.
Savage, yeah, absolutely. Any time Milinkovic-Savage is on a football pitch, you look forward to watching that.
Don't forget to pay yourself for the money that you've lost, Andy.
I'm a welcher. I've got no chance.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Anna Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.